This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, whenever you're listening to this podcast. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. On November 15th, Wayne McPhail from HarrowSmithNow.com got to sit down with Dr. David Suzuki. This was just a few days after Donald Trump became president-elect. So, as you can imagine, they had a lot to talk about. They touched on environmental issues in a time when facts don't matter. They talked about David Suzuki's life and even career choices that he might have made. You can check out the full video interview Wayne did with Dr. Suzuki at HarrowSmithNow.com. Here's the audio of that interview, generously shared by our friends at HarrowSmith.
One of the things I found really interesting in your book is you were talking about Nelson Mandela and how you admired the fact that despite what happened to him, being in prison, and he still managed to embrace his captors and deal with that and say good things about them and actually came out positively. But your family went through being in camps, dealt with racism, and you said that you didn't feel that you could be like him, but you faced stuff like him. So how do you not become bitter from that? How do you keep from being?
Well, I've seen what incarceration had done to my father. Mm-hmm. But you know, you got to think about, I was a child when we went through it, and in many ways protected from the real reality of what it meant to be uprooted and set out east eventually. I mean, I never thought of ourselves as poor. Mm-hmm. And yet the whole time we were absolutely impoverished. But my father, who was in his early 30s when World War II started, I think was shattered by the disillusionment in his country. He was born and raised in Canada, and you know, this was his country, and it let him down. And I think he was very bitter, but that bitterness was in many ways self-destructive. Mm. You know, it ate away at him, and I think in many ways prevented him from really wanting to make a commitment to do something for his country or in his country. I mean, he's a wonderful man, but I think that it really hurt him in a profound way. But you know, the kind of thing that Mandela, it's like, I'm not a Christian, so but when I think that a guy 2,000 years ago said, if someone hits you, you turn your face and let him hit you on the other side. Like, that to me is, it's so incomprehensible. I mean, to lash back would be your natural inclination. Mm-hmm. And yet it simply perpetuates that kind of violence, which is what Nelson Mandela recognized as well. Now, you know, he went through true physical difficulty and yet managed to emerge out of that. I'm sure inside there were moments of, or, you know, a lot of anger and bitterness and so on, but he didn't manifest that. And it made possible, I think, a peaceful transition to a non-apartheid world, which was really a stunning achievement. Right. I don't think I could do it. I think it was superhuman. And in many ways, it sets a bar that is so high, there aren't many people that could live up to that.
So I want to come back to a couple of things. I want to come back to your father in a little while, but just want to pick up on the idea of doing things. That one of the things I found interesting when you talked about your past life is you said, you know, I could have been a diamond cutter or a minister or a plumber. So do you ever think back now, geez, I would have been happier if I was fixing pipes right now?
No, I never think back on my life and wonder what if. I mean, I just don't see the point of looking back and regretting or wishing for a change. We are what we are. And those, you know, diamond cutter, preacher, those are ideas that my father thought would exploit certain characteristics, I guess, he saw in me. But you know, those were impositions on me, and I think the deeper thing he did for me was to feel a sense of obligation to work really hard to prove that Canada had made a mistake, that we were worthy. I think in many ways he also saw me as a vehicle to prove to his mom and dad that they were wrong. My grandparents emigrated to Canada shortly after the turn of the 19th century. And their whole thing, they were uneducated, very poor. They came to Canada for opportunity, as is the case for many, many of the immigrants to this country. And so they knew that Canada was a racist country in the early 1900s. But if you worked hard, you could get ahead. And so their whole thrust was work hard, earn money, buy property. That was, and for some reason, my father was never that way. I mean, he worked hard, and but he was totally irresponsible in terms of money. It was my mother that really stabilized the family income, but he really knew how to enjoy himself. He loved gardening. He loved fishing, of course, camping, all those things. He just loved to do it. My wife always says, why couldn't you be like your father to enjoy the moment? He was a remarkable man, but he was always considered as the eldest child in the family, a failure by his mom and dad. Mm-hmm. And I remember them berating him at our weekly dinners at their place for taking time out to take David fishing instead of working. You know, everything was, look, you could have been making money and you were doing these frivolous things. And
so I want to pick up on that, because one of the things you said about your dad in terms of relationship to his grandparents is that he was a mutant.
Yeah.
Right? And mutation, obviously, as you know, is valuable for natural selection and change in the species. So how much of your father's mutant genes do you carry, do you think?
Yeah, well, I said that as a joke. I used to say, Dad, you're a mutant. And I certainly didn't believe that he was an expression of some kind of genetic combination. Mm-hmm. But in the biological world, a mutation, the vast majority of mutations that occur upset the system, mm-hmm. and they're deleterious. But of course, the occasional one comes up and is greatly beneficial as conditions change. And certainly for me, I feel I was the inheritor of the enormous benefits of my father, in the sense that money and the need to just do good, prosper, was never a driving force, because it was never for my father. Working hard, yes, he instilled that in me. But he knew that there was more to the world than just making money. And I've always been grateful to him for that. Yeah. Now, I've told him, God damn it, Dad, you know, I'm working my ass off, but I don't have to all the time. But you instilled that in me as well. And yeah, I had to work much harder than any white person in order to get ahead.
Right. So one of the things you said in terms of your dad saying work hard is that he was dead wrong about the value of playing sports.
So boy, I guess, you've been reading all my stuff, haven't you?
Yes. So I guess my question is, and I think this is probably hard for people, but looking back, when you think about what you've told your children and your grandchildren over the years, what were you dead wrong about?
Oh, gosh.
Pick one, or?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess I won't get to see. I think possibly I have leaned over backwards not to act as if my children were somehow special in the sense of praising them like mad. When Severn, at a very young age, started, we were amused by, you know, she'd get her friends and do little marches to protect the animals, and we thought it was amusing. But as she achieved fame, I made a point of not really praising her, and because I didn't want her to think she was somehow special. I hope she understands how very proud I am of her, but I never really have expressed that with my children.
Just again, when you're going back to your being young, I'm thinking about your father building crystal radio sets. And you, in two occasions, when you had measles and Asian flu, were in a position where a lot of your entertainment came from radio.
Yeah.
But you're in television a lot, and radio. So I was reading that, and I was thinking, how much of the preference which you have for radio comes from your grandfather's crystal radios and your moments where you were sick, and that was what got you out of that?
No, well, I mean, that could be. It's interesting. Our television set at home is very seldom on, but the radio's on all the time. Mm-hmm. And that could very well be. I mean, radio was the big medium when I was a child of communication. And when I started Quirks and Quarks, I absolutely loved it.
Yes.
And it was very, very difficult for me to give it up. I had to make a choice. Am I going to really stay doing Quirks and Quarks, or was I going to spend full time on The Nature of Things? Because it had expanded from a half hour to a 1 hour show. Yeah. And I was going to be the center of the series. And the only reason I chose The Nature of Things and gave up Quirks and Quarks was it had a bigger audience.
Right.
The irony, of course, is that today I think Quirks and Quarks gets a bigger audience than The Nature of Things, because the television audience has just been fragmented so much, and kids now are not watching television nearly as much. I don't know if they're listening to radio. Certainly I see them plugged into their earbuds all the time,
and
but I suspect it's
quite dismissive
music.
Of that.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I think the idea that we're ultimately social animals, and yet our technology enables us to shroud ourselves in a cocoon of our own electronic devices. So when I see people walking around with earbuds in, as I was looking in the subway the other day, you know, half of the people in the subway were engaged with their cell phones. The message is clearly, don't bother me. I'm in my world and I don't need you. So I think it's unfortunate.
But if you look back to, say, the 1950s and photographs of people on commuter trains, commuter buses, they had newspapers in front of their faces, right?
Oh, well, that's an interesting point, yeah.
So, and I guess, you know, because you are concerned about how kids are using cell phones and stuff, but for them, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, are their way of getting information, misinformation or not, the same way radio and television is for you.
Yeah, it's true. The problem that I see, you know, I'm a big fan of Avaaz, which is they send in information and, you know, there's torture going on in this country, and they give you lots of good information, and then I'm able to, you know, submit my name and vote and become part of millions of people objecting, which is an amazing thing. They can do that in 24 hours, you know. Trump just got elected. Let's show him that there are a lot of us out there that don't support him, and boom, you've got 6 million people saying, Trump, you know, we want you to know. That's very impressive, but it's so easy to just read down the information and push a button. And I wonder, is that what movements are about, social change is about? The most superficial, easy thing we can do?
Slacktivism.
I'd never heard that, but that's a good term. It's that we are filled with so much information flooding us.
Right.
That we don't have time to do more than just read a little bit and push a button. And somehow I just can't believe that is where profound change comes.
And I guess one of the problems too, and it's certainly coming up with the recent US election, is that there in social media there's a ton of fake news and a ton of fake science, you know, pseudoscience that's propagated, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the really distressing part of the election and the whole campaign is that facts no longer matter. Mm-hmm. And that is really frightening. I mean, my whole public career is based on the notion that people make better decisions when they get better information. I felt people were illiterate in science, and yet science, when it was applied by industry, medicine, and the military, had a profound impact. Mm-hmm. And you can't just delegate that to politicians or the corporate community to make decisions about that. I felt the public needed to be involved in how do you make those decisions as to what technologies we're going to accept. Mm-hmm. And so I felt in order to do that, they needed information. That's been the whole thrust of my career, has been try to provide the most credible, sound information that people can get so that they will make better decisions. Now, clearly, that's all out the window. And the chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, a man named Jim Hogan, who owns a PR company, wrote a book recently that's a bestseller, I'm Right and You're Stupid. That's the title of his book.
Right.
And it looks at what is it that influences us to make decisions, to come to conclusions. And it's clear it's not about truth or information. The fact is the brain, through our experiences, our gender, our religion, our socioeconomic class, or our ethnic identity, all of those things shape the brain, which is a gigantic editing machine. The brain receives impulses from all our senses, but that edits it to fit and make sense within the worldview that the brain has been programmed to see the world through.
And the paradigms.
And boy, oh boy, to shift that is really very, very difficult. And that's why I've been saying for a number of years now, the environmental movement failed. Fundamentally, I mean, there were enormous successes in the first 20 years from after Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. Mm-hmm. But many of the battles that we fought back in the 60s and 70s, which we won, we thought, stopping dams, stopping oil supertankers along the coast, stopping drilling plans in the ocean, those have all come back exactly the same way today, 35 years later. So we didn't change the paradigm. We're still looking at the world the same way that drove us to be destructive in the first place.
And I guess somebody like George Lakoff would argue that you missed the frame, right? That the frame isn't, you don't own it.
Exactly.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to talk about, too, was we talked about fact and science, and we have Trump in the U.S. now appointing Myron Ebel, who was a climate change denier, to help through the changes to the EPA. Right? So there's a great example of facts don't matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think the shocking thing about the election was that all 17 candidates for the Republican nomination, every one of them was a climate denier. Mm-hmm. And the guy that won says climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese.
Right.
So, and yet he says, but I'm willing to be convinced if I see the data.
Right.
Like, what the hell is going on? Like, it's just, we really are in a Looney Tunes world. Nothing makes sense anymore.
Right.
So if you look at the people he's appointing, though, it's clear. Mm-hmm. The agenda that he's on becomes clear. The fact that he has appointed a man now who's from the extreme alt-right movement, this to me says that racism, sexism, those things are going to be deeply embedded in this administration.
Okay. So that brings me to the South American story you talked about with the hummingbird carrying a single drop of water into a forest fire and saying, hey, you know, I'm doing the best I can. And you identified with that hummingbird. But the corollary of that is the forest fire kept raging, right? So I guess, you know, fundamentally, as I read your latest book, I really felt a sense of doom, not hope. You know, I was feeling, especially now with the election in the U.S., I just thought, as you said, all of the battles are coming back.
No,
ecocide is very possible.
We're going on a very, very destructive path that scientists have been warning about for 40 years now. We haven't really turn from the path that we're on because it requires a fundamental paradigm shift, and that ain't easy. But the hummingbird story to me is an inspiration because, you know, yes, the hummingbird's drop of water in its beak was insignificant. But what if all the bears in the woods said, hey, if we go and pee on that fire, if all of the deer and all of the rabbits and all of the foxes and everybody began to join in, they could put that fire out. So that, to me, is the hope. We've got to each do the best we can. And to me, that story liberated me from the conceit that I was so important, like I had to go and that had to be my priority. If I don't do this, all hell's going to break loose. When I realized and looked in the mirror one night and said, who the hell do you think you are? You know, you're one person. There's 7 billion of us now. Mm-hmm. You're a drop in the bucket, but you could fill any bucket if there are enough drops. So you just do the best you can.
Right. So do you still believe that? I mean, given all of the subprime mortgage disasters and no response to that, that puts anybody in jail, what's happening with the tar sands, what's happening with climate change denying, are you still optimistic that you and other people like
you? I'm not an optimist or a pessimist. Optimists believe good things will happen. Pessimists say bad things are going to happen. I'm enough of a realist to see where all the curves are going. Clive Hamilton, an eco-philosopher from Australia, wrote a book, Requiem for a Species. Mm-hmm. We're the species the requiem is for. Mm-hmm. I've read that thing from cover to cover. There's nothing I disagree with, except that he concludes in the end, it's too late. There's nothing we can do. And a number of my colleagues are now saying that. Eminent scientists, Sir Martin Rees, James Lovelock, Guy McPherson, they're all saying it's too late. We've passed too many tipping points. To them, to all of them, I say thank you for the urgency of your message. We're in a mess. But if you're going to say it's too late, please don't say that. Go the hell away. Shut up and go away. What's the point? I mean, if you're going to fight to the end, we need that sense of urgency. But to say it's too late Guy McPherson is a retired ecologist from the States. He talks about the methane gun. Methane is 20 to 80 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Large deposits of methane in the Arctic, in the ocean. And as the water warms, just a little bit of warming, and those clathrates of methane melt, and you're now seeing in Siberia that bubbles are coming up, and you can light them because it's methane coming up. He says that we're getting to a point when you're going to get a massive release of methane, and that's going to be the gun that will suddenly cause catastrophic climate change. And when I read the book or his speech, I couldn't move for a week. I just felt, what the hell? What's the point? To say it's too late, it doesn't do any good for anybody, because we're going to fight to the end. And I think you have to give people a constant sense of hope. That's all we have. And my hope is not just a Pollyanna-ish, oh, well, you know, I hope things will happen. It's based on the fact that I know we don't know enough to say it's too late. And I use a concrete example of that. In the most valued species of salmon is sockeye salmon. Mm-hmm. It's got this bright red flesh that's very fatty. We all love sockeye. The biggest run of sockeye in the world is in the Fraser River, and we like to get 20 to 30 million sockeye coming back spawning. In 2009, we got barely over a million sockeye, and I vividly remember turning to my wife and saying, well, that's it. There isn't enough biomass to get them up to the spawning ground, so they've had it. A year later, we got the biggest run in 100 years. Right. Now, I use that not to say how stupid I am, because nobody knows what the hell was going on. Right. Nature shocked us. And I believe nature has got many, many other shocks up her sleeve, some not good, but some very hopeful. And that if we can pull back and give nature room, she will be more generous, I believe, I hope, than we deserve.
Right. So the final question I have is, and it's a question that a lot of people your age or my age ask, is, you know, as you sort of wind up your life, I don't mean to be terribly fatalistic, but what do you regret?
Well, that's a question I'm always asked as well. There are simple things I regret, silly, stupid, inconsiderate things that I did to people. You know, I regret making my wife cry when I just was so angry that I knew that she was vulnerable and I made her cry, and it was, you know, there are things I've done with people.
With your mother when you said,
I can't even talk. I used to talk about it in my speeches, and I can't do it without breaking down. I mean, that was just such a stupid thing that I did to my mother. Those things that I've done and said, the way I've treated people, certainly in my love life, I've done things I really regret very much. Mm-hmm. But in terms of my actions, in terms of not having done the right thing or ignore, I just don't live with that, because we all make choices and we're not omnipotent. We can't make the right choices all the time. I did the best I could. Yeah. And I like to think that I never did anything in a malevolent way, yeah, that I always had the interests of my family and my country in my mind as I did those things. So, yeah, I am a ultra fallible human being, and I did things to other people that I wish I hadn't.
Right. Well, thank you for doing the best you could.
That was a conversation between Dr. David Suzuki and Wayne McPhail from HarrowSmithNow.com. You can check out the full video interview that Wayne did with Dr. Suzuki by going to HarrowSmithNow.com. Thanks to Wayne McPhail and HarrowSmithNow.com for letting us use that audio. This has been a Rabble Radio special. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. This has been a production of Rabble.ca.